is Bad Boys and Beyond with your hosts, Mike Payton and Keith Black Trudeau.
That's it, baby, I'm foul.
Hey, I'll put it in the front page, back page, middle page, wherever headliners, column one or two, we will win game two. Good back it off, we will win game two.
The game's over and the Pistons have won the world championship.
Welcome back to Bad Boys and Beyond. We are your hosts, Mike Payton and Keith Black Trudeau. We're back. We took a week off. I think Keith might have been sick. I was super busy with, before the Lions won that game against the Broncos, I'm pretty sure every Detroit Lions fan thought the world was going to come to an end. So I just happened to fight the entire internet for a week. So it was just nice to... It was nice to kind of take a little break, but we're back with a big one. This is a huge one that we've been talking about forever. Joe Dumars part two. We did Joe Dumars one. It's in our archives. You can go find it. If you want to listen to that before you listen to this, go right ahead, but make sure you come back because we're talking about Joe Dumars as a GM, as an executive from 2000 to 2019. And then we'll even maybe talk about his little stint with the Kings and his time with the league itself. So, but first, Keith, the current Pistons, lost their 24th game in a row the other night to the Atlanta Hawks. And I have a question for you. What is the definition of insanity?
I believe it's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results.
No, I disagree. Yes, that is one of them. The other one is this weird feeling that I feel where I'm just in my head, I'm saying, well, screw it, man. Let's just go for the record. Let's just do it. How bad can it get? For some reason, I, as a fan who has loved this team my entire life and will continue to, have turned into, I'm so mad about this. I turned from, I'm so mad about this, to, well, let's just see how bad it can get. Like, I kind of want the record. I don't know why I want the record, but I do. Like, if you're going to go be bad, then you might as well go all in and be bad, because I don't see anything getting better. And I know every week somebody's saying, well, maybe this is the game. Maybe Atlanta's the game. Utah has to be the game. And then after they lose, they go, well, they looked better in this one than they did in the last loss. And it just sucks, you know? It sucks because I watched Cade Cunningham get a career-high 43 points the other night, had a terrific game. Doesn't mean anything. We'll never, ever remember it because it was part of this.
One of the most meaningless 43-point games I've ever seen in my life, and it's not because they were empty stats or he was inefficient. No, Cade Cunningham played legitimately very well. It's that the Pistons were getting blown out almost from the opening tip. And pretty much every point he scored from that point on was inconsequential to the result of the game. The final score looked a lot closer than the game really was. The Pistons were down 15 to 18 points most of the middle two quarters. They closed it a little bit in the fourth, but they never got closer than two possessions. The only difference between that game and the previous three was they were playing the Hawks instead of the Sixers or the Milwaukee Bucks. That was really it, the difference in competition. The Hawks weren't good enough to beat them by 35 points. Now, this Thursday, that's the game I've had circled for a while because the Utah Jazz are easily, I think, the worst team they've played since the Portland team that began this streak, I believe, however many weeks ago. Utah is a bottom five team in the NBA, both in offensive and defensive efficiency. I don't want to say they're in the tank because they have some legitimately good talent. Like Lauri Markkanen is an all-star. He can go off for 40 to 50 on any given night. But in general, Utah is not good. They're not trying to be good. They will be on the road tomorrow on the back end of a back-to-back. I think the spread, they're still favored by a point and a half. But that's really nothing. That just shows that against a team coming off of 24 straight losses, that this is kind of a toss-up. And I do expect the Pistons to win tomorrow. And that's the first time I've been able to say that in over a month. but I do expect them to win. If they don't win, I guess I'm not rooting for this simply because the players don't deserve it. I don't get me wrong. I think management deserves it. I think ownership deserves it. They all deserve to have this on their resumes. But if we're being honest, they're all hiding right now. I don't think Tom Gores is leaving the state of California anytime soon. Troy Weaver doesn't have to speak to anybody. He hides in his office as he does every year. This isn't a new strategy for him. Same thing with Arn Tellem. Same thing for Ed Stefanski. They are all simply hiding away, refusing to show their faces, make a statement, talk to anybody. So if the Pistons do break this record, the only people that are going to have to face the music are the players who were woefully unsupported and ill-prepared for the season. And likewise, the coaching staff, which has also been, look, Monty Williams is being very well paid. That's very well known, but his lead defensive assistant, the guy that he was going to be relying on this season to lead his defense, Dan Burke, has been absent since the Pistons were 2-2. They've lost 22 straight games since, or 23 straight games since. So he's been shorthanded as well. So I really don't want them to get the record because I don't think the players have quit. I don't think the coaches have quit. I think they were put in a terrible situation. They've had some bad luck. But this does not look like a team that is unaware that they're on a historically embarrassing losing streak. They just can't stop it. And so for that reason alone, I'm going to be rooting for them to win on Thursday.
Well, don't get me wrong. I mean, I want this to end too. Yeah, but there's that cynical part of me that says, well, that's just, if we're gonna be bad, go all in. And part of that relates to, well, I'm just hoping that, my God, if they beat the record, something has to be done about it, right? Like someone has to go after that, but nothing will happen, realistically.
Someone had to go after they lost 15 in a row. Someone had to go if they lost 20 in a row. I just don't see it. If they're going to fire somebody, I think it would have happened by now. But look, Tom Gores can he ha it's his prerogative. He can change his mind any given Friday and decide he's going to fire everybody. He's done that twice already. So I'm not saying that nothing's going to happen and no one's going to get fired here, but I just don't know that crossing that threshold of 26, 27 losses in a row is going to rattle anybody into making any rash changes. Because I even if, look, even if they win on Thursday, is that going to change anybody's outlook on this team, on this franchise?
No.
No, I like if they win tomorrow, they'll be, what are they right now? 2-25. So
Yeah.
if they win tomorrow, they'll be 3-25. Does 3-25 sound any better than 2-25? It really doesn't.
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, it does sound better than, I mean, two losses is really bad. Three is really bad, but it's an improvement. I do have one question before we get to our main topic today, and that is an interesting thought that came to mind the other day. Are the Pistons bad enough that they could get the coach from another team fired when they eventually win a game? Because
No.
if you're the team that loses to this team, I mean, God, that makes you look really bad, especially if you're a team that already has a losing record.
Maybe, look, in under a very specific set of circumstances, I could maybe see that. The problem is Will Hardy was one of the best coaches in the league last year. He did an amazing job with the Utah Jazz. They were a playoff team before they decided to tank and sit everybody. So I don't think Will Hardy, no matter what Utah does this year, I don't think his job is in jeopardy. I think he has a lot of people's respect, and everybody understands that Utah is trying to go into the tank this year. So if they lose to the Pistons, I think that's okay. Now, like if they were to beat the Lakers or something, and yeah, maybe they go
That's
crazy. Yeah, and in Darvin Ham, all of a sudden maybe Darvin Ham's job is in jeopardy. I don't know. That's not going to happen. I'm just saying.
right.
I just don't see any realistic scenario where they break the streak and then the coach of the other team gets fired the next day.
Exactly. Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, when you coach LeBron, you're sort of always on the hot seat,
Exactly. Yeah.
but so yeah, that's an interesting thought. So, all right, we'll see what happens on Thursday night. We'll see. Maybe that first win's coming. If it's not Thursday, then I honestly don't know when it's going to
Yeah,
be.
if it's not Thursday, I think they're going to be setting all kinds of records for futility.
Yeah, Brooklyn twice, Boston, Toronto. That's just the end to end the year, and then you've got Houston who's playing really well. Then you get another chance at Utah on the third, then the Warriors, Nuggets, Kings. It's just a gamut.
I mean, there are some, especially the Cavs don't have anybody. Half their team is injured, and it's going to be that way when they play them again. So
But
there
that's
are a
not
few teams.
until that's
Yeah,
not until
Jay,
January
yeah,
31st.
and Evan Mobley will still be out. So,
Oh.
Darius Garland will still be out, I think. So,
Yeah.
look, there's a few chances that they have for wins. The Spurs, the Rockets, the Cavs. They may sneak up on somebody in between that, but they have more chances to win games after this one.
Yeah. Speaking of Joe Dumars, which we're about to start discussing, I sent you that picture of Dennis Rodman's Bulls hat the other day. Well, the series came out, and man, you have got to see these hats. They look pretty awesome. There's a Pistons hat, white. It's white, Pistons logo, blue Bill, green under Bill, and then on the side it says back-to-back champs.
Oh, I like that.
I will be purchasing that one. Although, here's the funny thing. So they release hats for every team that Dennis Rodman played for and have little Rodman stuff on the side of them. Why are the Mavericks on here? I mean, I know he played for the Mavericks. I have a card to
There's
prove
your
it.
answer. Because
But
he lived in Mark Cuban's basement for 2 months.
that very I mean, publicly went horribly wrong.
Well, so did his time with the Spurs.
Yeah, the Spurs. There is a Spurs hat. There's also a Lakers
So
one
did his
too.
time with the Lakers.
Yep. I just thought that was interesting. But they're gonna release T-shirts and stuff too. So I can't wait to see when everything comes out. But anyways, let's get into Joe Dumars. Now I told you, Keith, that I had a take on Dumars before we started getting into the meat and potatoes of what we were going to talk about. And here's that take. And
Okay.
maybe you'll agree with me, and maybe you won't. When I looked everything over today, I saw a guy who was pretty good at his job outside of enough drafts to really sink things, enough bad draft to really sink things, and a really bad summer of 2009. I think otherwise, if he would have done some different things and got some things right, he'd still be the GM of this team today.
Okay, so yes, 2009 was a really bad summer, but he had more than one really bad summer. It's just that every time he reset from that really bad summer, he would start over again with another really bad summer once he cleared the deck. We'll get into it, but Joe Dumars was somewhat a victim of his circumstances and somewhat a victim of his own bad decisions. And even beside that, he was one of the best GMs. He had one of the most spectacular GM runs of any executive in NBA history.
For sure. I think there's a lot of bad breaks in here, and we'll kind of get to those as we get to it. But to start this whole thing off, when did you first know? We've sort of talked about this in the past, and when we had Grant Hill on, he brought it up too. But when did you first know that, okay, it's pretty evident Joe Dumars is going to retire and he's going to go right into the front office?
Well, it's kind of interesting because it felt exactly like Isaiah's last year. When everyone knew 93-94 was going to be it for him, everyone just assumed he would make his way into the Pistons front office and he would take over as GM eventually. And if things were in place for that to happen, and through certain events, certain people were offended, namely the owner of the Pistons, and it just he decided to banish Isaiah from the franchise essentially for a little while. And so that, GM in waiting spot was open, and all of a sudden Isaiah Thomas went from being the surrogate son of Bill Davidson to Joe Dumars being that guy. That was his tennis partner for his last few years. They were very close towards the end of his playing days. So when Joe Dumars announced that the lockout season of 99 was going to be his finale, everyone assumed that he was going to move into the front office and take over, especially since there really was no GM at the time. It was Rick Sund in charge, who he was the guy assisting Doug Collins when Doug Collins was general manager, and he had already been fired. So Rick Sund was almost like an interim GM that they just hadn't replaced yet. So everyone assumed as soon as the lockout season ended, Dumars would step right into the front office and make some moves, but that's not entirely how it went. So here's actually what happened. Joe Dumars had the self-awareness to understand that he didn't know how to be an executive right out of the gate. He had just retired. So the plan was for him to step in as to be named vice president of the Pistons, but to sit and wait behind Rick Sund and watch Rick Sund run the team for a year and get a feel for the business. And then after the 99-2000 season, then he would step in as general manager, and that's what happened.
Well, he takes the job, president of basketball operations, on June 6, 2000. And one of the first things he does is drafts Mateen Cleaves.
Yeah, so in hindsight, this looks like a really bad idea, even though the 2000 draft was a weak one, a historically weak one. Mateen Cleaves was still not even close to one of the top 10 players in that top 12 players in that draft. However, looking at it in context, Grant Hill was still with the team. And the one thing that Grant Hill really lacked in his time with the Pistons was having a pure point guard to take the ball handling responsibilities off of his plate on occasion. And to me, that this is was what Dumars was thinking when he picked Mateen Cleaves, other than the hometown hero angle of it. That, and look, theoretically, I could see how Mateen Cleaves would have done an okay job playing with Grant Hill, playing in their up-tempo style with George Ervin. Of course, none of that materialized because Grant Hill would never play for the Pistons again, but I saw the logic behind the pick.
Man, if he would have picked Michael Redd, we'd be talking a whole nother story right now, I think.
Well, yeah, but a lot of NBA team. Michael Redd almost went undrafted.
Right.
I mean, yeah, he was clearly one of the best players in the draft, and it's just none of us knew it at the time. So we go into the summer of 2000, and right off the bat, the biggest free agent on the market, Tim Duncan, was on the market, but no one thought he was going to leave San Antonio. He almost did, but no one was really talking about let's land Tim Duncan. Everyone was talking about let's land Grant Hill. The Detroit Piston forward was the biggest name on the free agent market in the summer of 2000, and there were a lot of teams with some money to spend. And this was seen as like Joe Dumars stepping immediately into the fire. This was his first big responsibility, was to get Grant Hill to come back. Grant, who was one of the top five players in the league at the time. But I don't think Joe actually saw it that way, because how his, by all accounts, how his meeting with Grant prior to free agency went was, you go out, you go and see what's out there for you, and then when you come back, we'll talk. And maybe Joe's strategy there was to show Grant some respect, that they knew each other, and that he didn't have to sell him on who Joe Dumars was, that Grant already knew. They already had a long-time working relationship. But I don't think that's how Grant took it. Because, when you're a free agent, you still want to be wooed, even if it's from the team you're already playing for. So that was almost seen as maybe like, we don't really need you. And maybe that's how Joe Dumars really thought at the time, because look, he wasn't going to not re-sign Grant Hill, but if you look at their roster, they were kind of stuck with Grant and Jerry Stackhouse and all of the role players that they had that were not great role players, but they still cost money, and the team was well capped out if they had re-signed Grant Hill. So they would have no real room to maneuver. So maybe in this, maybe it's just this conspiracy theory in my mind, but maybe Joe secretly just wanted Grant to go somewhere else, even though he couldn't publicly say it. Because as soon as Grant left, announced that he was leaving for Orlando, that gave Joe Dumars all the freedom he needed to blow the team up and to start from scratch. And once he did that, to his credit, one of the greatest rebuilding jobs in NBA history. And I will stand by that.
No, without question. Well, even that summer, obviously, as we know, Grant Hill went to Orlando, but it was as a sign and trade. And in that sign and trade, they got back one of the greatest centers to ever play the game in Ben Wallace, who wasn't that Ben Wallace yet. I mean, he was just a guy who was everybody looked at as an up and coming, somewhat of an up and coming player, but no one thought it would ever reach the level that it did.
Yeah, Ben Wallace, and this is a guy that Joe Dumars had played against. He'd seen him many times come off the bench and give his own team fits. He knew Ben Wallace very well. He knew that he wanted Ben Wallace on his team with or without Grant Hill. It just so happens that it worked out very nicely in a sign and trade package. They were both free agents. Chucky Atkins was as well. So, people just assume that, or they have this false assumption today that Orlando had Ben Wallace and Chucky Atkins and decided to trade. That's not how it happened. They were free agents, just like Grant was a free agent. And it just worked out that they could weave an extra year into everybody's deal if they just did worked out a sign and trade. And that's what happened. But yeah, how it looks on paper, it looks like Joe Dumars just pulled off the greatest trade heist in NBA history.
Well, it only gets better from there. And I mean, I don't know how much we really need to talk about the 2000-2001 season outside of obviously drafting
Well,
Mateen Cleaveson, but it's not a good season. It's 32-50. You fire the coach afterwards. It's really that 2001 off season where like that's where like a whole bunch of stuff happens.
what sets the table for that great 51 season in 2002 was what he did immediately as GM in the summer of 2000 to clear the deck, to clear cap space. He essentially he trades Christian Laettner for expiring contracts, trades Lindsey Hunter for expiring contracts, Terry Mills for an expiring contract, and he doesn't get useful players for anybody. It's just that he's able to clear players that were rotation players in a playoff team, get their long-term contracts off the books, and take in veterans on expiring contracts that maybe couldn't play anymore, but that was the point. And you still had Jerry Stackhouse, you had Ben Wallace. They weren't an awful team. They were just, garden variety bad. But once that happened and they ate that 150 loss season, and like you said, in only 1 year, Joe Dumars is able to start building back up again. And he doesn't do, the let's tank for 5 years and get high draft picks. He actually blows his one high draft pick, Rodney White, takes him with the ninth pick in the 2001 NBA draft ahead of Joe Johnson, who was picked one spot later. It was a terrible, terrible pick in hindsight. Rodney White was barely an NBA player. But the point is, he didn't need to because he wasn't focused on relying on his draft picks to build his team up. He was always trying to get better, no matter who was available. Now, if you throw that one, and we kind of glossed over in the middle of the 01 season, he trades Jerome Williams, a fan favorite junkyard dog, for Corliss Williamson and a first round pick. And then we went over this in our mailbag episode. But he uses that first round pick down the road in a way that I don't think any GM has ever used it, where he essentially gives it away in exchange for the Orlando Magic screwing over the Memphis Grizzlies, because the Memphis Grizzlies could have given the draft pick that they owed for the Otis Thorpe deal. They could have given the Pistons, or they could have given the Grizzlies a pick to send to the Pistons in like the 19th or 20th pick. And Joe Dumars sends it to them, and they refuse to make that deal, and it winds up benefiting hugely down the road. But I don't have 20 minutes to go over that, so we're going to move on. But yeah, aside from the Rodney White, the summer of 01 was just a master class. He hires Rick Carlisle, one of the league's top-rated assistants from Indiana. Rick Carlisle, who should have been the head coach of the Indiana Pacers, but they they swooped in at the end and they denied him for Isaiah Thomas. So Carlisle was suddenly free. So Dumars picked him up. He trades a second round pick for a 30-year-old for the rights to a 30-year-old rookie named Zelko Rabracha. He trades a couple of his expirings that he got when he tore the team down. Judd Bushler and John Wallace trades them to Phoenix for Cliff Robinson, who winds up being on the all-defensive team that next season. Mateen Cleaves, he realizes his mistake. He punts on Mateen Cleaves after 1 year, trades him to Sacramento for John Barry. And what
One of
does this
Keith's
all?
favorites.
Yes, absolutely. And what does this all result in? The Pistons, who were favored by Vegas to lose, I think 51, 52 games that season, they have their best season above expectations, maybe in franchise history. They win 50 games. And Carlisle, the coach that he hires, wins Coach of the Year. Ben Wallace, the guy he traded for, Grant Hill for, wins Defensive Player of the Year. Corliss Williamson, who he traded Jerome Williams for, wins Sixth Man of the Year. And John Barry and Zelko Rabracha also combined to lead the most productive bench in the league by far that season.
What a
And
year.
somehow he doesn't win Executive of the Year because whoever it was for the Nets traded Marbury for Jason Kidd, and that was a brilliant deal, apparently. But that was I never even cared who won Executive of the Year before to the summer of 2002. I'm like, how does Dumars not win this? It was just unbelievable.
If you're curious as to, it's Rod Thorne, who made that trade.
Yeah.
Good for Rod, I guess. What did that get Rod? Well, he did get the Nets to two NBA finals in a row, so we'll give him that.
He did, but it's like, is trading for Jason Kidd really a brilliant move? All right,
Oh,
so
no, it seems pretty I don't know, easy to me. Like, hey, yeah, trade for the really
like
good
his
guy.
best acquisition that offseason was probably what, Richard Jefferson
Yeah.
in the draft? Like that was a good draft pick, but
Well, speaking of draft, I mean, are we moving on to 2002? Because this is the one, right? Like this is.
yeah, so
So
2002.
may I take
Okay.
this one? May I take
Yeah.
this one? I'll
Please.
let. Okay. All right. I'm gonna
Mike
take this one.
has the floor, everyone.
I'm gonna take this one. I can't wait. All right. So in June he drafts Tayshaun Prince. 1 month later, he drafts. He trade. Or excuse me, signs Chauncey Billups to a 6-year deal. Then
Mid-level.
mid six. Yeah, 6-year, $34 million contract. Then. Trades Hubert Davis, Bobby Simmons, and Brian Cardinal, and Jerry Stackhouse was part of this deal as well, and Varda to Washington for some guy named Rip Hamilton. And I mean, it's what a summary. He like in this summer alone, he built a championship team.
All right. I think some guy named Rip Hamilton is a little bit
All
selling
right, okay, but he was a guy who was scoring like 20 points a game, but that
a
Michael Jordan didn't want to
little.
play with anymore.
He was the MVP of the Final Four and in a top 10 draft pick,
You know what
averaging
I
just
mean.
about
You
20
know what
points.
I
Okay, I'm just saying he wasn't a
mean.
nobody.
No, he wasn't a nobody, but he wasn't like
But
a
yeah.
superstar or anything either.
No,
Not
you're
yet.
absolutely right. Yeah, no, the consensus was that the Pistons ripped themselves off in order to save a little bit of money, and that if Rip Hamilton were to make the Pistons better, it would be like 2 to 3 years down the road because he was younger than Jerry Stackhouse. But no
Right.
one
And
thought.
Stackhouse just scored what 28 points a game, so
Well, no. 0-0-2, I think he scored like 22 or 23. Like his final season with the Pistons, he didn't shoot quite as much, and his assists went up. He was more of a playmaker. But for some reason, he didn't make the All-Star team. But we won't get into that. But yeah, you're right. This was the first year really of the mid-level exemption being like a factor in free agency. And Chauncey Billups, the most sought after point guard in free agency that summer. There was double digits, like 11, 12 teams all lining up for him. But what Dumars did, into his credit, to get an advantage was. His pitch was, look, we have a 51 team. I am giving you the keys to the car. You will be my starting point guard from day one. And no one else is going to offer you that. None of the other teams that want you are going to offer you an upper echelon playoff team, guaranteed starting spot. and you can have the keys to the car. And that was enough to get Chauncey Billups to sign. And again, that's another one that was a risk. Chauncey Billups was not, a hugely celebrated free agent signing, especially in locally in Detroit. Not everyone was sold on him. He was very still much still seen as the draft bust that had played on five or six teams.
Wasn't there someone else? There was another point guard that summer. Who was that?
Jeff McGinnis.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah, the Clipper free agent from the I think he had been with the Clippers at that point. But yeah, there was especially locally on like Pistons message boards. I'm kind of dating myself there, but there was a lot of hefty debate going into that summer of who would you rather have, who would you rather Joe Dumars sign, Chauncey Billups or Jeff McGinnis? And look, I would say it was about, I'd say Billups was the favorite, but it was like 60-40. Like there was plenty of people that thought Jeff McGinnis was more of a value signing because he would cost a little less, and he was a little bit quicker than Billups. But the bottom line is, I don't think anybody knew what Billups was going to turn into, except maybe Joe Dumars.
Yes, he obviously turns into one of the greatest players in this franchise's history. Yeah.
Yeah, so on the strength of those moves, again, this is a guy that could have easily just sat on his hands after winning 50 games, and shocking the whole league, but he saw how limited his roster was, and he took some swings, he took some risks to make upgrades, and he did it, all of those things. He gets Tayshaun Prince in the draft. He gets Chauncey Billups in free agency. He trades his star player Jerry Stackhouse for Richard Hamilton, because Hamilton was a much better fit. And you know what? They were a better team the next season. They won as many games as they did the year before, but they were far better equipped for the playoffs. And Billups and Hamilton led them all the way to the conference finals. And who else led them? Tayshaun Prince, the rookie that he had drafted well out of the first round. And not only that, a guy that I don't even think we mentioned, Mehmet Okur, who was a draft and stash, the same type of pick that everybody groans when the Pistons take a draft and stash guy because they never work out. Well, you don't remember Mehmet Okur, do you, apparently? They took him in the second, Joe took him in the second round the year before, let him sit in Europe for a year, and then brought him over a season later, and then he was almost as effective a rookie as Tayshaun Prince was, and he had some great playoff moments himself. It was just another master class by Dumars, and this one actually did earn him Executive of the Year.
Hey Keith, how's Balsa
I wouldn't call him a
Kuprivica
stat. Like if you're playing college ball in the United States, you don't qualify as a draft and stash. I'm
Okay.
sorry.
All right.
You're just not good enough to play in the NBA.
Right.
We'll see down the road. On the I forgot I got his name
No,
forget.
so you have not given up on Kuprivica, is what you're saying.
Not quote. No. I have given up on. I
Oh,
gave
okay. All right.
up Kuprivica the day they drafted him. No, I was thinking more of the Italian. I cannot remember his
Oh,
Gabriel Procida.
Luigi DiTomei.
No, Gabriel Procida. Procida.
Proceeded. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's actually going to work out down the road.
Okay.
All right. So if you look at what Joe Dumars has done his first 3 years, master class. Takes one offseason to tear his team down, one offseason to build it back up, and a third season to augment the team that he had built up, make them even better. So he's going into year four of his tenure. And look, he's smelling like roses right now. This is yet another year where he could have sat on his hands and waited. And he does to a degree, but he does with a purpose. So 03-04, Joe Dumars kind of, everyone's kind of expecting him to make an enormous move, and he doesn't. He kind of sits on his team in free agency, sits at the beginning of the season, waits for all these other contenders to use up their ammo, trade their prospects, their picks for other players. And there's one player in particular that Joe has his eyes on, and that's one Rasheed Wallace, who is struggling, not struggling, but his relationship with the Portland Trailblazers is struggling. And He's about to be a free agent. He's an expiring contract. The Blazers are bad. They're getting worse. And so it's just obvious that they need to move on from him. And Joe does have talks with the Blazers, and they just never go anywhere. The Blazers are just asking for too much. They asked for Darko, I think, at one point, and that sounds ridiculously. Yeah, of course you'd say yes to that now, but back then, Darko was still the number two pick in the draft. So a few years, or excuse me, a few months into that season, Portland does trade Rasheed Wallace. He trades him to the Atlanta Hawks for Theo Ratliff and Sharif Abdur-Rahim. So Joe does not give up. He then turns his attentions onto the Hawks, who he knows will take less in return for Rasheed Wallace than the Blazers did because they're still in the same spot with him. They only got him for his expiring contract. They didn't really care. The Hawks were terrible. So going up into the trade deadline, they have no reason to hold on to Rasheed Wallace for what would be like a 2 month rental. So at the trade deadline, and this is still one of the most exciting trade deadlines I've ever experienced as a fan, everyone's waiting on pins and needles because this is no secret that that Dumars is trying to get Rasheed Wallace. And a few hours before the deadline, news breaking news comes over the radio that the Pistons have a deal in place to acquire Rasheed Wallace. And this is a deal that was years in the making. One of the picks, he said the Pistons send the Hawks two first round picks. Well, they send it's a three-way deal. They send the Celtics a first round pick, their own, for 2004. And they send the Atlanta Hawks another first round pick. And Joe Dumars had that first round pick because he traded Rodney White to Denver the year before. The pick that he blew, that he realized that he blew it. So, and then he was able to get value for Rodney White before the entire league knew that he couldn't play. So this was a deal that he had been building towards really his entire tenure. And there's really nothing else to add there, other than this deal makes the Detroit Pistons champions. And by the way, we kind of skipped over Larry Brown, and we really shouldn't have because. Go ahead.
Well, we'll get back to that in just a second, but you brought up the idea that people kind of expected him to make a big move in the summer of 2003, 2004, and I was just looking at some of the available free agents, and I thought maybe I would ask Keith who he would have liked to have had on the Pistons at that time, just off a handful of guys. I mean, would you have loved to have had Alonzo Mourning in Detroit?
Well, I remember at the time it was kind of because he had just come off of his kidney surgery. No one really knew if he could play anymore or not. It wasn't that the Pistons had cap space. They didn't. What they had was a ton of expiring contracts. And that was it, back then, expiring contracts were gold because the salary cap was still so small and the luxury tax had just been instituted. So expiring contracts 20 years ago were worth a lot more than they were now. So it was just a matter of Joe Dumars picking on a team with a very expensive star player that they wanted to move to cut payroll.
Here's a guy that I think would have been good for this team, Juwan Howard.
Juwan Howard was a good player for most of his career. And yeah, I think he would have fit in very, very well with the Pistons team that really did need another big man, another post player.
Some other guys that, and we won't waste too much time on this, but some other guys: Karl Malone, Gary Payton. Obviously, they both signed with the Lakers that year. Scottie Pippen was available. Robert Horry. Gee, I wonder if we would have signed Robert Horry. What would have happened in 2005? Maybe should have
I
made a
don't
deal on that one.
think they had the money to go after Robert Horry. Scottie Pippen was very much he, the only reason he had a job that season is because the Bulls brought him back for like a ceremonial farewell tour. But he could not play anymore in 2004. I remember seeing him.
And then, the last one, the guy that they actually did sign, Eldon Campbell, wound up being, I mean, just a perfect
Huge,
off the bench.
hugely underrated. Yep.
Just a
Hugely
great, great
underrated.
addition. So you mentioned that they did fire Larry Brown, or excuse me, they did fire Rick Carlisle and hired Larry Brown in the offseason. And I feel a different way than everybody else does about Larry Brown because I didn't like that he was only here for 2 years and then left and went to New York. I don't like it. And I wonder, couldn't have Rick Carlisle just led this same exact team to a championship? I mean, this is a championship winning coach we're talking about.
Maybe. Well, he was a championship coach 10 years down the road. But yeah. So here's my take on it. Rick Carlisle and Larry Brown are very, very different types of coaches. Rick Carlisle is all about efficiency. He's all about doing what the numbers dictate. He's all about patience, precision. Larry Brown wants to kick your ass. He is very much a like a Mike Ditka, just a, more of a soft spoken, but his style is very much a well, shock and awe. We want to cause chaos defensively and make you quit. So Rick Carlisle's, I don't think Rick Carlisle, as great a coach as he was, I don't think he was as good a fit for that Pistons team, especially with Rasheed Wallace, as Larry Brown was. Larry Brown was able to, that was like his dream team. He was able to design traps and zones and all sorts of defensive wrinkles with Rasheed Wallace and Ben Wallace and Tayshaun Prince and Billups and Hamilton, with all those guys at his disposal, and Lindsey Hunter and Mike James. It was just Joe Dumars gave him Candyland to play with. That was just, he could do anything he wanted defensively. And what he did was he crafted the finest defensive team of all time for one season. So I just, it's a hard time for me to see. It's hard for me to see Rick Carlisle pulling those same levers. Like maybe they win with him anyway. I just, that team was built for Larry Brown to coach. I'm sorry, but it was.
I do wonder though if they keep Rick Carlisle, does Darko Milicic have a better career? I think he does.
No, simply because I look. Darko had many, many chances with many different teams, many different coaches.
But never a good one. I mean, never one that wanted to give him the time.
Oh, no, Orlando wanted to give it. Orlando traded a first round pick for him. Orlando wanted to give him the time. Minnesota gave him a ton of money. It's just, he just didn't have the desire to play basketball the way he needed to bring out 100% of his ability. He had the ability. He just didn't care enough about what he did for a living, as harsh as that is to say. And look, that's part of that is on Dumars. He drafted the kid essentially based on word of mouth and, a couple of workouts. He didn't actually watch him play until after he drafted him, which is unheard of today. It was just a major miscalculation on Joe's part. And look, we can't not mention the fact that he passed on Carmelo Anthony and Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade for, Darko Milicic. It was, look, at the time, it was well known in many NBA circles that Darko was seen as the best, second best prospect to LeBron in the draft. So I think most GMs would have picked Darko second, but that does not excuse it. You can't just say, oh, I picked him because everyone said to pick him. That's not your job. Your job is to pick the correct player, whether it's the popular pick or not. And Dumars, even though it didn't cost him a championship in 04, it very much cost him down the road.
I have one more thought experiment, and then we're going to stop doing that. In 2003, with the second pick in the draft, he doesn't take Darko, he takes David West. Are we upset today, or are we like super happy?
David West.
Yeah, David West.
Yeah, we
I think we're pretty happy. I think
with the
we're
second
good.
pick.
If he If he had used the second pick on David West over Carmelo, I'm just trying to put in a different idea. Like the idea is always, well, he
Yeah,
didn't draft Carmelo, he didn't draft Dwayne Wade, but what if he drafted someone else who has actually turned out to be a pretty decent player, but
well,
not as good as those other guys?
look, it would not have been seen as a nuclear disaster, but you would still would have said, yeah, we had David West, and David West, a really good player, a borderline all-star at his peak, but you passed on three guys that are superstars. They're like, if you pass on one guy that's a superstar, fine. Maybe that just slipped through the cracks, but passing on three of them that almost came immediately after all three of them, three, four, and five, all superstars in their own right. It's just hard to unsee that. It doesn't matter if you drafted Darko or David West or, whoever else in that draft that had a legitimate NBA career. It's like, taking a Bill Cartwright over Larry Bird. Like, okay, you drafted a really good player, but you passed on one of the greatest players ever. And that's just kind of how I look at it.
All right, well, that's a good little thought experiment there. But let's get to the big thing here. That year, 2003, 2004, Joe Dumars becomes the first ever black executive to lead an NBA championship team. It had never happened before that time. It's insane to even think about that.
It's weird because like there's not that many look there are so many great teams in NBA history that have won like three, four, five, six championships in however many 20 years. There haven't been that many championship winning GMs, I guess, is what I'm getting at, relative to what you would think there would have been, especially since the league started, and the league integrated their front offices way faster than baseball and football did. It's just I just don't think there had been enough black executives that had a legitimate chance to win an NBA championship before Joe Dumars. But yeah, it is kind of shocking that the first time it happened was 20 years ago. I think it's very much about opportunity more than anything. But look, even at that point, like what team, kind of team did Joe Dumars take over, right? Like, it's not like he was handed the keys to a Porsche either. He just happened to work miracle after miracle, and the Pistons had one of the greatest rebuilding jobs in the history of the league. And I say that because they never won the lottery. They never had a big name free agent agree to just show up for a contract. He had to do it the hard way, and the vast majority of the time, when you do it the hard way in the NBA, you don't get anywhere. You certainly don't win a championship.
Well, there you go. So you heard it here from Keith. Troy Weaver's doing it the hard way. I mean, the really, really hard way.
Oh, Troy Weaver actually won the lottery.
It's still, well, if this is winning the lottery, if this is the easy way, then Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I know. No, you will get no argument from me. Troy Weaver has done a Look, you can't just rely, if you're going to rely on nothing but your draft acumen to build a franchise, not make any meaningful trades, make very few meaningful free agent signings, you better be the best damn scout that's ever lived. You better be the best GM on draft day that's ever lived. And Troy Weaver is just good on draft day. He has not been great. And you would need to be great in order to keep your job and do nothing else other than draft players. All right, moving on.
Moving on, 2005, bringing in
Yep,
Dice.
2005. Well, also he Joe Dumars kind of has a tough decision to make in the summer of 2004. So he has Mometo Okor. Everybody knows he's blossoming. He's going to be a very, very good player, if not a star, someday. Rasheed Wallace, who won you the damn championship, is approaching 30. He turned 30 that summer. And you don't have enough money for both. He back then, second round picks that were signed for fewer than 2 seasons did not retain their bird rights when they became free agents. So Joe Dumars either had enough cap room to sign Mometo Okor, in which case he would have had to renounce the rights to Rasheed Wallace and essentially give up on him, or he could re-sign Rasheed Wallace and he would have to give up on Mometo Okor. So he signs Rasheed Wallace, and I still think it was the right move. But what I'm saying is that was a tough decision to give up on a very promising young big man for essentially nothing because you wanted to retain your team. And yeah, the Antonio McDice signing, especially a guy that had reconstructed knees, no one knew if what his future would be in the NBA going forward. He gives him the mid-level, just like he gave Chauncey the mid-level. It was a great move, but in order to do that, because the Pistons went $500,000, I think, over the luxury tax to win their 04 championship. And word was sent down from on high from Bill Davidson that he would not miss another year of getting luxury tax checks. So in order to make that happen, even though he could have signed him for the mid-level anyway and gone over into the luxury tax, he was not allowed to do that. So he had to clear up some salary. So in order to do that, he had to give away Corliss Williamson essentially to the Sixers. The guy had won Sixth Man of the Year 2 years prior to that. Essentially gave him away for Derek Coleman's much cheaper expiring contract. And that always kind of burned me because, one of the problems, one of the reasons they couldn't win a championship after 04 was their lack of depth. And as he kept retaining his starters, they kept getting raises, and that money had to come from somewhere, which meant he had to, make cheaply build his bench. He had to worry about, pinching pennies and stuff, and that was kind of a detriment going forward with Dumars.
I kind of like the draft picks though. I don't think they look that bad. Amir Johnson,
We're skipping forward a year, but yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, 04, he had no draft picks. He
No
traded them
draft
for,
picks.
he had, yeah, because he had two and then he traded them for Rasheed Wallace.
I thought we were on 05.
Yeah, so going on to 05, which is, let's fast forward, but I want to note one thing is that even though the Pistons made it back to the finals in 05, much was made about Larry Brown constantly looking over his shoulder and flirting with other teams, the New York Knicks specifically, and kind of making, side door negotiations. Like if things don't work out with Detroit this year, what kind of a contract would I be looking at? And word got back to Bill Davidson, and Bill Davidson was furious and he wanted Larry Brown fired before he could leave. So, despite Larry Brown leading the Pistons to two finals in 2 seasons and winning them a championship in one of them, just as Rick Carlisle was, Larry Brown is fired after 2 seasons. And to be fair to Joe Dumars, I don't think he had much say in either of these.
Well, as you mentioned, Larry's gone. They bring in Flip Saunders, which I was a huge fan of. I liked Flip a lot. And rest in peace, Flip. It didn't work out towards the end, but I thought he was the best logical next move for them to make at head coach.
I think Flip Saunders would have been so much more of an effective coach today, to be honest with you, because he was one of the pioneers of zone defenses in the NBA, just pure zone. And it didn't really work in his time. It worked to a degree, but you could always, there was always a point where it would break down and he would just have no counter. Today, everybody plays zone, so he would fit right in. And he was one of the most offensively efficient coaches, in the history of the game. And he didn't have, super teams to work with. He had great players, but he never had great, unstoppable teams. It's just it, players running his motion-based systems, they always looked better. They always did. And you know what? That it was same for the Pistons. Rip Hamilton looked better offensively in Flip's system. Chauncey Billups looked way better in Flip's system, and he had a Finals MVP under Larry Brown. Ben Wallace did not care for Flip Saunders for obvious reasons because Flip took away from the things that made Ben Wallace great. But the bottom line is, the Pistons started out 37-5 under Flip Saunders. You can't knock the hire. It was just they didn't have enough when it came to playoff time because the Dwayne Wade, one of the guys that Joe passed on, he would have his revenge that season, and the Pistons would get eliminated in the conference finals. But look, they had their best record in team history that year, 64-18, with the guy that he replaced Larry Brown with. So I really would like to get away from the revisionist history that Flip was a bad coach. No, Flip was a terrific coach. I just don't think he was, I don't think he was a great fit coming off of Larry Brown. I think he was too different.
I guess I would be my point. But midway through that season, Joe Dumars, as he has done three times now, realizes that he has wasted a first round pick on the wrong player, and he needs to trade him early before the rest of the league catches on. And he trades Darko Milicic, essentially admitting his failure in the 03 draft. He trades it for a first round pick a year down the road from Orlando, but we'll get into that later.
I will say that this is also the year that Joe like starts getting really good at drafting guys that are going to be good somewhere else. Because, like I mentioned, Amir Johnson,
Yeah, Amir would be exhibit A.
yeah, he's fine in Detroit. He's fine. He's okay. Toronto, he's a great player in Toronto. Not great, not a legendary, but he's a good player in Toronto. He's a solid guy that you want on your team in Toronto. But not in Detroit.
Amir Johnson, the very last high school to direct high school to NBA player in NBA history. But because of that, he was very young. He was barely 18 years old when they drafted him. They knew it would take him a while to develop. And the problem was they kept having to re-sign him and re-sign him. And then by the time he developed, he was on his third contract at age like 23. So it was just, I guess Dumars felt that he didn't get his money's worth. And then the Toronto Raptors benefited from all the work that they had put into developing him.
So,
Following the 06 season, I already mentioned Ben Wallace didn't get along with Flip Saunders. And lo and behold, Ben Wallace is a free agent. And once again, the luxury tax rears its ugly head because a year down the road, Chauncey Billups is going to be a free agent. And Dumars knows he has enough money to retain one of them. He does not have enough money to retain both of them. So he has two choices here. He can re-sign Ben Wallace with the knowledge that he will probably lose Chauncey Billups the following summer. Billups, who's younger and just coming off of a season where he was an MVP candidate. Or he could simply let Ben Wallace go with the knowledge that he's older and he probably won't be worth whatever he signs for in the long term, and just try to see if he can replace him. So instead of going all in for 2007, Dumars tries to think long term. And he allows Ben Wallace to walk away to the Chicago Bulls for what was it, 4 years, $60 million. And look, the logic was sound. Ben Wallace was good for exactly one more year, and then he fell off a cliff. Not literally, just figuratively, but still, his game suffered as he got older. But the problem is that doesn't help the Pistons, right? So Dumars winds up having to replace Ben Wallace with a much cheaper option. Nazi Mohammed, I think 6 years, $36 million was the contract. 6 year contract just sounds insane today.
On Nazi Muhammad, especially. But
Yeah.
not that Nazi was like, he was fine, but like not 6 years
He
fine.
was an absolutely terrible fit with the Pistons. He didn't have Ben Wallace's mobility on defense. His hands were terrible on offense. He was a good rebounder, okay post defender. But just the drop off in defensive impact at the center position was just massive. And it took them a while to adjust to it. The Pistons started out only 21 and 15. They were a mid-tier team in the East until a gift from the gods falls into Joe's lap. And Chris Webber, who is ailing with two reconstruct or a reconstructed bad knee and some other ailments, the Sixers let him go. They buy him out so he can sign with a contender. Joe Dumars picks him up. Shrewdly, I might add, he moves into the starting lineup ahead of Muhammad almost immediately, and the Pistons go from 21 and 15. They finish the season 30 and 12 with Chris Webber in the starting lineup. It is a move that changes their entire season around, really saves it from being a disaster. And even though it ends in the conference finals, just like the previous,
We don't need to
yeah,
talk about it.
we don't, because it has nothing to do with Joe. But my point is, Joe was able to salvage that, even despite him making a very poor decision. He was able to go out and find somebody that other teams had given up on. And Chris Webber, despite his numbers, had a major impact on that 2007 Pistons team. They were actually very fun to watch towards the end. They had great chemistry. Weber is just, even with the inability to move his feet, Weber was still just so much fun to watch, playing off of Hamilton and Billups and Rashid.
I'd never really seen Weber have so much like razzle dazzle too. Like he was moving the ball well, like not just shooting and all that, but he was moving the ball well. And I think he brought a real, real spark to this team that would go on to lose to exactly one player in the Eastern Conference Finals.
One plus Boobie Gibson.
Boobie was there too. And Danielle Marshall.
Boobie Gibson, whose career lasted exactly one game, that was game six of the conference finals. He just completely outplayed Chauncey Billups for some god-awful reason. All right. So now we go to 2007-08, and this is really Joe's swan song as an elite GM.
This is kind of...
And this is... When I call fans spoiled sometimes on Twitter, this is what I'm referring to. You don't appreciate what you have.
Joe Dumars goes out, has a very fine draft, takes Rodney Stuckey with a pick he got from Darko Milicic from Orlando, uses his own draft pick on Aaron Aflalo, the 27th pick in the draft, steals Aaron Aflalo. He's finally able to go out and fortify his bench with... Theo Ratliff, Jarvis Hayes, Juan Dixon. I like these aren't necessary. Walter Hermann. These aren't necessarily big names, but they're names that fit very well with
how the Pistons played.
That very deliberate half court style. He's able to move on from Nazi Muhammad somehow on a guy on like a 6-year contract. He was able to move that for without giving up anything necessarily,
and it all fits. It all works. I think. He did an outstanding job in the summer of 07, and it turns into a 59-win season. The Pistons are suddenly better than they had been since 2006. And yet it seemed to go unappreciated, at least locally. And I know because that was my final year to this date living in the Metro Detroit area. I had season tickets. I was there every game, and it was like, it was almost like fans got bored of this team winning because they didn't think that they could win a championship and it was just championship or bust. I know the media, as particularly on sports radio, they hammered them all the time as being stale and boring. And when are you going to blow it up so we can get some nice high draft picks, some excitement for the future? And no one really appreciated the present.
And I think that's kind of what led to what happens next.
The Pistons, despite winning 59 games, having the league's second best record, they go to the conference finals and lose to the one team with a better record than they had, the Boston Celtics. They could have easily have run it back the next season. They could have easily have done that, but
things were put into motion because I guess it was decided that,
the paying customers wanted change for change's sake.
And so after their third straight conference finals loss, Joe Dumars fires Flip Saunders, who, by the way, with the Pistons has a career record of 176-70,
a winning percentage of 715.
It's the dumbest franchise that ever existed.
Incredibly far and ahead, far and away, the greatest winning percentage in franchise history, and I don't think anyone will ever top that. Look, he's not the best coach. Chuck Daly, we'll say Chuck Daly is the greatest coach. I'll even put Larry Brown up there. But Flip Saunders was not chopped liver, and he was treated like chopped liver. He was treated like he could replace you with anybody and get these results, and clearly that didn't happen.
I just can't believe that we were like this, We were like this as a fan base. I would kill for this now. I would kill for a 59-win basketball team.
59-win season and in a conference finals appearance, and it was treated almost with disgust.
It's unbelievable that we were like that.
Oh, we all knew you wouldn't win the title anyway, see? You should have blown it up 2 years ago. You should have traded everybody for high draft picks. Now we're stuck with these old guys that all they do is win games. Anyway.
Fan pressure could be a bad thing.
So Joe Dumars had this saying early on in his tenure. It said, And this stems from his experience as a player with the Bad Boys. He said, you're going off the cliff one way or the other. You can either jump off or you can be pushed off. And in his experience, he watched his championship team, the Bad Boys, as a player be pushed off because they kept it together. He decides to go the other way here. He decides to jump off a year early because they at least had 1 year left in them. He trades Chauncey Billups a week into this following season. Chauncey Billups, who he had just re-signed the year before to a big money extension, he trades him to the Denver Nuggets for Allen Iverson. Why does he do this? Not because he's in love with Allen Iverson. Iverson was older. Everyone knew he was slowing down a little bit. He could still play. But the point in getting him was he was on a very large expiring contract, which, again, was gold back then. And that meant that by trading Billups' contract away and maneuvering some other things, he would be able to open up a huge swath of cap space in 2009. So Dumars essentially tries to have it both ways. He tries to compete in 09 with Iverson and then tries to rebuild on the fly. Tries to create the opportunity to rebuild on the fly in 2009.
Would it be accurate to say that he's attempting to do what he did the first time over again?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. I mean, he wasn't breaking up a championship team, though.
Right, that's true. But I think he was trying to just repeat.
He was breaking up a team that got swept in the first round. This was a much steeper. And look, we can go. I'm not going to mention the failed Kobe Bryant for Tayshaun Prince and Rip Hamilton. That was never going to happen. I don't buy that it was ever close to happening. And even if it was, Kobe would have voided it anyway. So we're not going to discuss that.
All right. So
replacing Flip Saunders, he chooses Michael Curry, one of his former Piston teammates. Michael Curry, first of all, the roster was never going to work, but Michael Curry made sure it wasn't going to work because he, for whatever reason, wasn't willing to tell his general manager that Rodney Stuckey was not the future of the franchise and Rip Hamilton and Allen Iverson needed to work things out together. And instead, he had a revolving chair where he was trying to force Rodney Stuckey into the starting lineup. First, he pissed off Rip Hamilton by asking him to come off the bench, and then he asked Allen Iverson to come off the bench, at which point Allen Iverson essentially said, "I'd rather not play for you anymore." And so he didn't. And so the Pistons, coming off a 59-win season, I think they won 39 the season after and got swept in the first round by the Cavs, with Allen Iverson already having been banished from the team. And that was the disaster of 09. 08, 09, and it would only go down downhill from here.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and take us into the worst summer of all. Oh, wait a minute. Keith's got one more thing.
Well, no. I was making sure we were – because towards the end of 2009, something very, very critical happens. Bill Davidson, the owner of the Pistons, passes away. Just before the end of that season. And even though had long been a succession plan in place, the problem is no one else in his family wanted the team. He had multiple sons, did not want the team. His wife did not want the team, Karen Davidson. But being his widow, the team went to her by force. And immediately she went about trying to see if she could sell it, just unload it. So
with that in mind, Joe Dumars, he puts his plan into motion, but it's kind of halted halfway through.
Well,
so all right, go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is the one. Like this is the year that everything. This is the year I remember that people started saying fire Joe Dumars. It's 2009, and I get it, man. He drafts Austin Day, and then we knew almost immediately that wasn't going to work out.
Austin Day. All right. Keep in mind, two picks after Austin Day, Jrue Holiday came off the board.
Yeah.
Jrue Holiday, who was still playing today, making $30-some million a year. Jrue Holiday, Austin Day has not played an NBA game, I think, since 2005. It's almost like 8 or 9 years since Austin Day's even played an NBA game.
Keith, even the very next pick of James Johnson would have been a better pick. You know what I'm
also
saying?
Also a guy that is still playing today.
Is still playing today, yes. You know, all the other guys who were left on the board, Jeff Teague is still there. I mean, Damari Carroll would have been better. Taj Gibson would have been better. I don't mean to pile on Austin Day, but it just even at the time, even when the draft pick was made, it didn't feel good. And then when he started playing, you could see immediately this wasn't going to work.
It was a swing on potential. And for whatever reason, anytime Joe Dumars has ever tried to take a swing on potential in a draft, it has backfired horribly. Rodney White, Darko Milicic, we're just mentioning him right now. Austin Day, a 7-foot small forward with a feathery touch that was just not very good at basketball. And it had proven that when he went to Gonzaga and had trouble in Gonzaga in a second tier conference. And he tries to go into the NBA as a, I forget if it was a one and done or two and done, but regardless, he did not have the physique for the NBA, even though he had the height. He was never more than a spot up shooter. And he wasn't necessarily great at that because his release was so slow. It was just watching Austin Day play, he was a guy that you would hope would turn into something someday, but you would never see the flashes. It was just, hey, he's a 7-footer that's mobile and can shoot. Maybe, obviously, someday he's going to be a player, and he just wasn't.
Now, then you head to free agency, and
yep.
Now, look, you and I both know that this isn't like, you know, the summer of LeBron or anything like this. But this is a time in which the Pistons had a significant amount of money. More than any other team. And the idea was, well, they could just pretty much do whatever they wanted. And there's guys like Carlos Boozer out there. Jason Kidd is available during this time, even though he's kind of pushing the end of his career. He's going to help lead a team to a championship 2 years from now. Like, there were players that were available, and he takes Ben Gordon and Charlie Villanueva. And to this day, these are the two worst signings in this team's history outside of Josh Smith.
Bison Daly was up there too, but
Bison Daly got a good year out of it.
Look, in Joe's defense, all the other guys you mentioned other than Millsap and Boozer were old, and he had a plan for Boozer to get Boozer anyway.
Right.
And look, Villanueva and Ben Gordon were both very young players that had very good statistics, at least, in their previous teams. And they were seen as being on their way up. And yeah, this was supposed to be Joe's idea of how to infuse youth into his lineup. And look, here's the problem. If you look at the roster, Rip Hamilton is still there. He's on an extension. He's not going anywhere. Or at least not as a free agent. Ben Gordon and Rip Hamilton are both exclusively shooting guards. They do not play any of their positions. So you look at that, and then you look at Utah. Utah has Carlos Boozer at the time, and Utah also has a guy named Paul Millsap that they're trying to – two power forwards. They cannot play any other position. They needed to move on from Carlos Boozer, just like the Pistons, theoretically, after this Ben Gordon signing, needed to move on from Rip Hamilton. It seemed there'd be a very, very obvious fit for all parties involved. And what happened? Supposedly there was a deal in place where the Pistons were going to send Rip Hamilton to Utah for Carlos Boozer, which would have balanced out both teams. And because Boozer had a larger contract and the Karen Davidson was still in the process of trying to sell the Pistons, they didn't, even though they were okay with signing free agents to big money, because by terms of the CBA, they had to spend that money. Trading short-term contracts for long-term contracts was seen as, that's something that a potential buyer may not like. So long story short, that rumored deal was not allowed to happen. Whether it would have happened or not, I don't know. I just know that it seemed very obvious to everybody at the time that, okay, you sign Ben Gordon to $55 million. We know there's got to be another move coming down the road to trade Rip Hamilton for a big man, and this could be a functional team, and it just never happened.
And because it never happened, 2009, 2010 was – it was a worse season than the one before. They missed the playoffs entirely.
Won just 27 games.
And yeah, the kicker was that he gave
Aaron Aflalo away. He had to, because he had no room to play him, because now you have two shooting guards making a combined $100 million.
And what does Aaron Aflalo go and do in Denver?
He is one of the most underrated two guards in the league in his time with Denver. Incredibly efficient two-way shooting guard. Basically all of the traits that Jumars would have loved to have in Detroit, except he got impatient and then forces out of his control essentially made Aaron Aflalo expendable.
And there's another example of a player that does much better outside of Detroit. That, I mean, like, it's yep. It's you could see that Joe has an eye for talent. It's just maybe he's just doesn't have an eye for coaching, or like, I don't know. That's hard to say, because he does have an eye for coaching. Flip Saunders, Larry Brown.
Speaking of coaching,
the problem is he can't fit these players in. Yeah. And speaking of coaching, one more thing. I thought this was funny. I don't know why, but you know, another free agent they missed out on this year, Kevin Ollie. All right. Okay. We'll move on.
All right. So, and in addition, they're still obsessed with trying to make Rodney Stuckey, who's still there. They're still obsessed with trying to make him the point guard of the future, when in reality, he was never really a point guard to begin with. So really with Stuckey, Hamilton, and Ben Gordon, you really have three shooting guards, to be honest with you, and no point guards.
That was a very frustratingly imbalanced roster. All right. So Michael Curry's fired after 2009. Replacing him is John Kuster, who was one of Larry Brown's assistants during the championship season in 2004. Joe, I guess, thought that would be a good bridge for the remaining veterans, and it wasn't, because apparently none of them liked Kuster when he was there in 2004. So then we go into the 2010 offseason. Greg Monroe, he picks seventh over players such as Paul George and Gordon Hayward, who were picked, I think, two of the next three picks off the board. That was another move. Guys that are still making $30 million a year to play today.
Greg Monroe has not been in the league in, what, 4 or 5 years?
It's been a while.
Yeah, the COVID year, he had some side work. But, yeah,
to be fair, we both have agreed that Greg Monroe should still be in the NBA right now in some capacity. At least we did a month or a year ago or whatever. Well, last time we talked about it.
He does sign your boy Tracy McGrady. It is a pointless signing that I don't think served any purpose. It is not McGrady's fault that he went to a horrible team. It's just he had like a couple good years left, and
one was spent on a team that missed the lottery or missed the playoffs by a wide margin.
John Kuster's attitude and his poor relationship with his team boils over, where it turns into a mutiny, where Rip Hamilton, most notably among other players, simply declined to show up for shoot around the day before the day of a game. It's just essentially skipping practice, and that makes national headlines for like 3 or 4 days, and it turns extremely ugly. And somehow that team wins 30 games. Comparing that to today, I just laid out all of the problems that this team had. Very poorly spent draft pick. Signed an over-the-hill free agent that was a shell of his former self. Your star player, your all-time playoff scorer in team history, decided that he wasn't going to show up for work for a while because he hated his head coach. All of this happened, and they still won 30 games. That is how hard it is to lose 60 games in the NBA. You can purposely be bad and still not lose that many.
So in the midst of all that, the Pistons are finally sold in the summer of 2011
to a man who still owns the team today, in Tom Gores. Which, and that's, you're thinking that's going to free up the checkbook, and to a degree it does, but it also comes with expectations, because now instead of a widow that is just trying to unload an asset inherited from her husband, you have an actual owner that has expectations in place, and now Joe Dumars is kind of forced to move his plans forward. So...
Lawrence Frank time.
Lawrence Frank time. Two things happen in the summer of 2011. Rip Hamilton is bought out. They paid him to leave. That's how bad it got. A guy that whose number is retired by the Pistons, a guy who was their all-time playoff leading scorer, so disgruntled that they paid him a year in advance to leave the team and go to the Bulls. That is one of the saddest sentences about the team I will ever utter. And, yeah... John Kuster, shortly after Boris takes over, Kuster's fired, and they replace him with Lawrence Frank, who was a better coach by any estimation, but not a coach that was, he was never going to turn the team around. Once again, much like Frankie, or much like Kuster, Frank was more of a drill sergeant than a player's coach. He butted heads several times with several players, but never to a point of a mutiny. Joe Dumars picks Brandon Knight that summer. Well, it was a lockout season, so it was wherever the draft was. He picks him eighth overall, one pick ahead of the Charlotte Hornets all-time leading scorer, Kemba Walker, someone that I really wanted for that draft. But once again, Brandon Knight was younger, physically bigger, faster. He was seen as a higher potential player. And every freaking time Joe Dumars swung on potential, he passes up on a better player. So in a lockout shortened season of 66 games, the Pistons go just 25-41. Very, very hard to win fewer than 20 games in the NBA. It just is.
Huh.
So
I know a team that's about to do it 2 years in a row.
Yeah. I having lived through all of this utility where things were going terribly wrong every year and they were still winning at least 25 games, 24 games, sometimes 30 games, despite themselves. And
yeah, comparing that to today, it's just unfathomable to me how you can be that bad.
Summer of 2012, Joe Dumars actually has a bit of a comeback. The one potential guy that he ever drafts that turns out to be a good player, Andre Drummond, takes him ninth. Pretty good pick. Not a home run, but worked out very, very well. I would say better than where he was picked. And with the 39th pick in the draft, steals Chris Middleton, who had missed most of his previous season with knee surgery, from Texas A&M, who was seen as a lottery pick with a bad knee. And... you know, he finally sends Tayshaun Prince on his way, 10 years after drafting him, sends him on his way to the Grizzlies so he can contend for a championship in exchange for Jose Calderon, which frees up cap space. The Pistons win 29 games, but Drummond plays very well. Chris Middleton misses, again, he's injured, so he misses most of the season. But towards the end of the season, he starts to play. And even though it's in meaningless games, he looks pretty damn good. he's starting some of them, and I can remember a few of them where it looks like, yeah, Joe Dumars really got a player in the second round. And then we go to Joe's final disaster summer of 2013.
Yeah, well, let's see what we've got on the docket for this one. So you know what it is. Signs Josh Smith to a contract, does a sign and trade for Brandon Jennings.
All right, so can I set the stage for this real quick?
Yeah.
Because I think we do need to mention the elephant in the room, and that is Tom Gores, who made it very clear this is Joe's fourth season under his ownership. He wanted to see progress. He wanted to see playoffs. So he let Joe Dumars, he opened the checkbook, essentially let Joe Dumars sign whoever he wanted, trade for whoever he wanted, but he wanted results. So he gave Joe Dumars the tools he needed to do the job, but he also restricted the time he had to do it.
So, like you said, go ahead and list them off for me.
Well, Josh Smith, and then the sign and trade for Brandon Jennings.
Yep.
And then you're going to move on from Chris Middleton, who what does he do after he leaves, Keith? What does that Chris Middleton guy doing these days?
He was the second best player in a championship team in Milwaukee a few years ago.
Yes.
He's declining a little bit now because of injuries, but yeah, right. He's a legitimate all-star player. Easily the best draft pick, the best player that Joe Dumars ever drafted. And it was the second round, and he essentially gave him away after what was essentially a one-month tryout period at the end of his rookie season after he came off the injured list.
Simply because he wanted Brandon Jennings. He saw Brandon Jennings as a player he could win with immediately. And when Milwaukee asked for Chris Middleton, he would not fight for Chris Middleton because he was so focused on getting Brandon Jennings.
Well, you know who else he signs that offseason, Keith?
You mean player wise?
2-year, $5 million deal. Chauncey Billups is back.
Oh, yeah. But Chauncey Billups doesn't last. I think the second year was a team option. But yeah, Billups coming off of Achilles surgery just had nothing left. And I mean absolutely nothing left. He had brought Ben Wallace back and it worked out very well. I'm assuming he thought the same thing would work out with Chauncey Billups, that he could have a good swan song in Detroit and they needed a point guard, but he just didn't have anything left in the tank. He couldn't move anymore. He couldn't get any lift. He couldn't shoot. It was more of a sad end than anything.
And really, that's this entire season, even though he had spent so much, gave Josh Smith a 4-year, $64 million contract, went out and got Brandon Jennings. He wound up getting a whole lot of pieces that just didn't fit together. KCP, he picked 8th in the draft. He's still playing today. That's not a terrible pick by any standard.
Just helped the Nuggets win a title.
Yeah, CJ McCollum, who was a legitimately better player, was also in the mix. It was really him. Or, you know, I know fans wanted Trey Burke, but Joe never really cared about Trey Burke. I know CJ McCollum was in the running, though. And that was another guy that Joe passed on. But ultimately, it boils down to this. 50 games into the season, the Pistons are at 21-29, and Tom Gores pulls the plug. History will record that Joe Dumars fired his own coach, Maurice Cheeks, half a season into hiring him. That is not really what happened. Joe Dumars, or Tom Gores, had Maurice Cheeks fired. And that is Joe Dumars' last official transaction with the Detroit Pistons, was firing Maurice Cheeks midseason because he was essentially stripped of his authority after that and removed after the end of that season.
And that's that. I mean, that's going to end Joe Dumars' time as the he does stick around for a while, but not as the president. He's like an advisor for.
He sticks around the same way Dwayne Casey is still around with the Detroit Pistons.
Yes, he's collecting a check.
Yeah, his contract didn't change any. They said we have a guaranteed contract with you. We're still paying you. We would still like you to come to work. We're just not going to allow you any authority.
Sounds like fun. I mean, I would do that job. Sounds like they're going to pay me for like 4 years to do nothing.
Yeah, but I obviously Joe did not take it that way because he has really not allowed himself to have any contact with the franchise since then. It is very obvious. Even though Tom Gores, I don't think, holds any animosity towards Joe, I think Joe holds a ton of animosity towards Tom Gores.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that, you know, when you just have your... You have it stripped out from underneath you, essentially. But Joe is done with the Pistons in 2019. He actually goes and works for the Kings for 3 years as a special advisor to the general manager. He was the interim executive vice president of basketball operations from 2020 to 2020, from August to September. And then he was the chief...
Yeah,
for 1 month, and he was the chief strategy officer, and now he works for the NBA as of last year. as the executive vice president and head of basketball operations for the NBA. That's a big boy job right there, kids.
Yeah, he is essentially the league's top disciplinarian. When they hand down suspensions, he's essentially the guy at the center of that, which is interesting considering Joe Dumars is also the man they named the NBA sportsmanship award after.
You know, another thing that unfortunately happened during this time was in August of 2020, Joe Dumars' field house was closed permanently. And that was a rough one for me because I had a birthday party there.
Which one?
At Joe Dumars Basketball City.
Okay, so I'm saying there was more than
one. Oh, the one in Shelby Township.
Okay.
Yep. I had a birthday party there. Good times. But that's it. That's going to wrap up the Joe Dumars GM episode. I hope everybody had fun reliving some of this trauma. But I still say when it's all said and done, I think, you know, a couple of bad breaks. And I really think it's a couple of bad breaks. And drafting on potential, as you mentioned, was something that really hurt him. But I think clearly in he was trying to redo exactly what he did the first time, which, hey, it worked the first time, so it's not a bad something to try again. But you're right, doing it from a different point of where the franchise was certainly hurt. But I don't think that Joe should get the hate that Joe got, because this man brought this team a championship, and no GM or executive has been able to do that since.
Yeah, I don't think Joe really gets hate locally. I think he gets more flack nationally for passing on Carmelo Anthony, Chris Bosh, and Dwayne Wade. He gets some locally, but I think more than anything, especially given how terrible the Pistons have been since he left, I think there's definitely a lot of appreciation for what Joe Dumars was able to accomplish as an executive. It's almost more impressive than what he was able to accomplish as a player. We're in year four of Troy Weaver's rebuild. The Pistons are 2-25 right now?
Yeah, 2-25. Yeah.
In year four of Joe Dumars' rebuild, the Pistons won the NBA championship.
Mm. Well, we're not going to be doing that this year. So we'll see where things go, and hopefully things get better for this team. Maybe hire Joe Dumars back. I don't know. Probably not. But probably. That's going to do it for this episode. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Next week, I think we're going to draft Cade Cunningham, right?
It's possible.
Or we could do the episode that we were supposed to do last week.
Oh, you mean the redraft versus you know what? Let's do Bill Laimbeer next week.
Okay, next week we're doing it, guys. Bill Laimbeer, former coach of the Detroit Shock, and I think he did some other stuff in the 80s. I can't really remember. But
he may have had a cup of coffee in Detroit at some point.
Yeah, I think he definitely played for a Detroit team at one point in time. And of course, you know what we're going to talk about, that video game next week. So we will see you guys then.